Hello, buongiorno, I'm Jason Solomons. You join me on a distinctly autumnal Venetian coast for the 67th Venice Film Festival. This year is proving to be full of surprises and terrible weather. I'll be catching up with Guardian critic Zan Brooks and Variety critic Leslie Felperin to hear of films by Darren Aronofsky, Sofia Coppola, Kelly Reichardt, and Ben and Casey Affleck, to name but a few. And Death in Venice. I meet the man behind one of the films tipped to take the top prizes here. Chilean director Pablo Larraín's thriller Postmortem transports us back to 1973 Santiago. I meet Pablo to discuss a painful era in South American history. Yes, it's a watery deluge of cinematic treats. It's Film Weekly. I may be here in Venice, but a big release back in the UK this weekend comes from a previous festival that we covered on Film Weekly. Yes, Cannes. It's the hotly anticipated adaptation of Posy Simmons' graphic novel Tamara Drew. Directed by Stephen Frears, the film tells of a feisty young journalist who returns to her hometown in the English countryside to reconnect with her past and inadvertently stirs up trouble with her surgically enhanced beauty. Just like Tamara's nose job, the film is also a new turn for director Frears, who has not to date explored the world of the rural bourgeois in his work. And so it was with a grin on my face and cheer in my heart that I met Stephen to talk cinema, sex, and fighting Hollywood with hot pants.
In your column you write about yourself. Does that come easily?
Not easily, it just feels right. My first novel is definitely going to be autobiographical.
Your first novel? You're going to dash one off just like that?
Ideally, I'd like to make it into fiction before I'm 30.
Then maybe a swimwear collection, chat show, pasta sauce range.
What?
Life sure comes easy for the beautiful.
You know, before I had the nose job, I had no problem being taken seriously. Maybe when they removed that bit of cartilage, they pulled out my brain by mistake.
Stephen Frears, how lovely to see you again.
Hello.
Welcome to Film Weekly once more. I know comedy's always close to a hot, but some people would perhaps be surprised by what they would see as a shift, even though the Queen was, I thought, hilarious in places. But people wouldn't see you as a farceur.
I mean, I've always thought comedy was rather unnerving. In other words, people either laugh or they don't laugh. If they don't laugh, you've failed. So this isn't... I've never quite... It's sort of... I mean, it's got a lot of... It's very funny. It made me laugh that I was making a film from a graphic novel, which is a very, very fashionable thing to do, except, of course, I wasn't making it about a superhero. So, as usual, I've got it wrong.
But the thing is, when you say comedy is unnerving, I think particularly for a filmmaker it's unnerving because you haven't got the audience to tell you when they're laughing. When do you find out whether you've got something funny in the can or not?
Eventually you get the courage up and show it to people, and luckily in our case they started to laugh. But it was very hard work, and you're endlessly shortening things and sharpening things. I mean, very, very interesting.
Interesting for you, even at this stage of your career, and we're not going to lie, you've made a few films, you've got a few years behind you, Stephen. Even there, you're still thinking, well, how do I visually tell this joke to its best ability?
Yes, absolutely. How do you present this? And I found all that very, very satisfying. And Moira Buffini, who wrote the script, was sort of brilliant at it. She was like an American gag writer. You just say, look, this scene should be like that, righto. And then she would go away and write it, and she'd write jokes in it and little things that were going on. She was very, very good at it.
We've talked often and long about influences on your career. Who have you admired from the comic filmmakers?
Well, I'm so old that, of course, the people I really admire are people like Billy Wilder and Preston Sturges and Lubitsch. Actually, David Thompson, the English critic who lives in America, he will talk about Lubitsch. He talks about my work in the context of Lubitsch. So somebody somewhere appreciated what I was trying to do.
I think it's because, as we've often said, it's hard to pin down to Stephen Frears' film what he'll do next, what sort of, you know, connects them all. And I think that's the same with Lubitsch. He was a craftsman and a filmmaker, but it's sometimes hard to tell, you know, what thematically or stylistically links them.
Well, I'm so old that I come from a more innocent age where, first of all, directors were invisible people. And the idea of film as art wasn't really on the menu. They were just there to entertain people. And really, art wasn't separated from entertainment. In other words, I grew up seeing popular films that were made by highly intelligent people like Hitchcock or Ford or whoever it was, or Lean or Carol Reed. and I've refused to change my position. Yeah. In other words, to me, you know, I want to make popular films that are intelligent.
Yeah. And I think if you look at Billy Wilder, what links Some Like It Hot with Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity, well, I don't know, apart from great performances and, well, and nice stockings.
And his wit, yes, his wit and his intelligence, yeah, and his observation of people, I suppose.
To go down that route, as you say, the director as auteur, which is a theory that sprung up even while you were working, yeah, has that been good for cinema in the long run, or is there some way that it's kind of split people?
I more and more think it's been catastrophic. I think it's made a bunch of, you know, hard-working people very self-conscious, and I don't like all that sort of self-importance and the solemnity of it all. I just, when I was a child, I used to go to the pictures, you know, with my mother or with my brothers or my friends, and you liked the actors and you liked what they did, and you didn't really worry about all the things that people have come to worry about, and you didn't talk about... So in a way, it was a more innocent time. Then people started to recognise that a lot of these people were, you know, the people like Hitchcock and Hawks and people, yeah, and Wells were brilliant. And then it got to the modern thing, which is sort of the celebrification of directors, and I suppose I'm rather against all of that.
If the cult of the director has in some way been harmful in a way, and we should get back to maybe a star system, which we don't have in this country either, because we now don't have a director system. The UK Film Council didn't really create directors, which I would have hoped it was going to do. Where do we go again now? I mean, people will ask you now as a senior statesman.
Well, quite frankly, actually, that's rather interesting. I've never had it put quite like that. Basically, you're in competition with the Americans, and the Americans are very, very good at what they do, and they're very clever and very smart. And only if you make something that's interesting and, you know, original and all those things can you really survive against them. Otherwise, they'll just sort of steamroll over you. Someone goes to the cinema and they can either see a film by me or they can see Avatar. So I have to be on my toes to entice them not to see Avatar.
Or Gemma Arterton in Hot Pants, that'll do it.
Well, that's smart thinking, yes. Yeah, I kept saying make them shorter.
But that was something about this film in particular. When I saw it first in Cannes, and I was struck by the very Englishness of it. And yet, I was looking around, and obviously at Cannes, you get the world there, and they were laughing as much. And it's the very specificity of it, I think, that has been the success of it.
This is a word that's begun to creep into my vocabulary. Tim Bevan said he would talk about specificity. So I guess it's very specific. I mean, I just think it's good writing and good, you know, it's people writing something that's Posey Simmons and Moira writing something that's very perceptive and accessible and funny. Yeah. I mean, I just say I made it because it made me laugh and I thought it was sexy and very, very fresh.
Yeah. But, it's as fresh because it's a take on the countryside. I mean, I don't go to the countryside very often. I don't know about you.
When did you last see a British film set in the countryside? I mean, Tom Jones was set in the countryside. Midsummer Night's Dream, I suppose. I mean, it's really that small. Yeah. There aren't films. So here was a film set in the English countryside, and also a film about the middle classes, which again the English don't make films about the middle classes.
No, I mean they make urban films about the working class mostly, don't they?
Or about the toffs. Mm. So given that we're all middle class, it's rather astonishing. Anyway, so I was immediately given two possibilities of transgressing.
And that middle class thing is rather fascinating, because the Americans, of course, make films about middle classes all the time. Everyone in there is a photographer or a journalist or in advertising. We cringe when those characters come on screen. Yeah. So it is great to see writers, Roger Allen playing a sort of well-heeled writer, and Tamsin Gregg doing it brilliantly. Is there a... I always find that people... That might be something that the people that grew up teaching you, Carol Rice, those kind of, you know, a bit of working class grit, it's good for you, it's grew up north.
Well, they led... I mean, the truth is that before the war, when they didn't make films about the working class, was idiotic. And then the changes that came in after the war meant that when we were all working in television, you know, there was a whole new subject that nobody had ever made films about, and that was very, very interesting. So I guess that's why the middle classes have been starved or been neglected in this way, or despised. Good God, you're making films of the middle classes. What a dreary idea. What a disgusting idea. Mm. Anyway, now they're objects of immense curiosity.
Yeah. I mean, for a long time, they were on TV in sitcoms and stuff like that, the Terry and Junes and the Good Life.
Penelope Keith, that's... Yes, absolutely. And the English can play all that stuff. You know, Roger Allam and Townsend, they can do this stuff in their sleep. They're so brilliant at it.
Roger Allam is an actor I've long admired on the stage. Doesn't seem to be in films enough. Was brilliant in The Queen. And he was almost a chorus figure in The Queen. And I thought that was the first time I thought, God, he's quite like Stephen Frears. And now I see him in this, and he's even more like. Is he your alter ego?
That's what my friend Hanif says. He says, well, now you can't make a film without Roger. He's so like you.
Yeah. And the comedy here, which we didn't mention comedy, there is an acerbic kind of, I wouldn't say that it's dark, but there is a bitterness or a bitter edge of the gods somehow kind of exacting revenge on these people.
Yes, absolutely.
And that gives you some kind of mischief, I can see.
It's an enormous pleasure. Yes, absolutely. You said you create paradise, then you cause trouble in it. Nothing finer.
It's very nice to see you again.
All right, my dear.
Not wearing tight denim cut-offs are Guardian critic Zan Brooks and Variety critic Leslie Felperin. They are, however, joining me to review the Venice Film Festival so far. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, like the Italian woman who starts every screening here. Leslie, you've been here since the beginning.
Yes.
So you've been able, you saw the opening night film, Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan, which kind of kicked things up. It kind of made people think there was a great buzz going on at Venice. Is that merited?
I think so. I mean, it was a fantastic choice for opening night film because it's a film about performances. It ends with, you know, rousing applause. So if the film had flopped with the real audience, you know, the applause in the movie would have covered it. But it was very strong, actually. Some people are more passionate supporters than I am, but I thought it was real style. I hated The Fountain, which was here 2 years ago. I wasn't here when The Wrestler was, but he's an interesting filmmaker. It's very rich. It's extremely camp. You know, it's a film. My quibbles with it are, as someone who does actually actively like ballet, I think he knows about as much about ballet as he did about higher maths, you know, on the evidence of pi. I think, you know, he thinks of it as a kind of companion, a sort of stablemate with The Wrestler.
Yeah.
And I think there's much more of a sense that he really actually did properly immerse himself in the world of wrestling in that film. This one, it's kind of a little bit really, for instance, you know, the very fact that her chief choreographer is straight and trying to get off with her was ridiculous for a start. I mean, I've never met a straight man in the world of ballet ever.
Natalie Portman has been getting a lot of kind of kudos here. People saying it's an Oscar-nominating kind of role. Is that the case?
I think it's definitely the best thing she's ever done. I've never been a massive fan of her. She's very beautiful to look at, and she has a certain kind of presence. But it's,
Leon, come on. That
yeah,
was good.
Well, of course, yes. Well, and then what else? You know, Star Wars, the early trilogy. She looks great in it, and she apparently trained for 10 months, but I don't believe it was actually her dancing on point. But having said that, she does move really well, and it's a kind of, she's perfectly cast for the part. There's a sort of brittle fragility that the part calls for that is just right in her bailiwick.
Brilliant. That's Black Swan, which Zan and I missed, so we turn to your greater wisdom. Another thing that Zan and I missed is Sofia Coppola's Somewhere, which I suppose was one of the big draws of the festival. It had its world premiere here. She was back here where, I suppose, Lost in Translation made its bow and kind of made her name as a filmmaker. Venice welcomed her, clearly, but it was another story about fame and daddies and daughters. She kind of ploughs this furrow kind of well.
Yeah, and infinitely well. I mean, I found it extremely charming. It's been such a strong festival, though, that funnily enough, the film's kind of slightly faded from my memory now that there have been so many other incredibly strong things. But it was a really interesting bit of programming because it resonated so well with the Casey Affleck movie, which we might talk about, I'm Still Here. Kind of, there's a funny kind of in-joke in a way of having Stephen Dorff as the lead, as some sort of uber-ableist Johnny Depp kind of guy. We all know Stephen Dorff is a kind of B-minus list, you know, almost been. So I thought there was some wit to it, and I think people could like, but it's quite artist. It's a bit like an Ozu film almost, set in LA. You know, it's very, very long scenes where not much happens. There's very, very little plot, very little drama as such.
From Ozu, I'm going to ask you about Ozon, who's another of my favourite filmmakers, whose film I missed here, Potiche, which starred Catherine Deneuve and Gérard Depardieu. Catherine Deneuve, the press notes I have, she's in a kind of velour tracksuit. Why?
She's limbering up and trying to get, you know, say she's an haute bourgeois wife of a factory owner. You know, she was inherited, and she has nothing else to do in her life except sort of go running and write terrible poetry.
So Catherine Deneuve runs.
Yeah, she
like
runs.
Garbo talks. Deneuve runs.
Yeah, yeah. But it's such a striking image and stuff like that. But it's absolutely delightful. I really, really liked it. The last couple of his films were underwhelming. He's made some great, but this is really back on form of sort of maybe perhaps one of his best films since, you know, Wheat Femme or Under the Sand. It was just, it had, it was poignant, but it was also very, very funny. And I think it shows off Deneuve's comic timing. She really has a great gift for comedy that we don't tend to associate with her, because we always sort of think of her as in things like, you know, Belle de Jour and the sort of the heavier Dark Veil Repulsion and stuff like that. So she really kind of sends herself up, and lovely chemistry of on-screen chemistry of Gérard Depardieu and Fabio Lacini, who's her Fabrice Lacini as her husband, and it was utterly charming, a real audience pleaser. If when it comes out in the UK, I'm sure people are going to like it.
Brilliant. That's François Ozon's Potiche. Then I think Zan and I kind of joined you, although there was one film that everyone is talking about here, which I have missed so far. I hope to catch up with it at some point. A Russian film called Silent Souls. Now, I got an email back from the bookmakers back in London, Paddy Power, telling me that Silent Souls has been instilled as the favourite, the 4-1 favourite to win. How would Paddy Power know this? I don't know. I'd like to be in a betting shop down the old Kent Road and say, I'll have 20 grand on Silent Souls. And the bloke go, what race is that running in? 3:30. Hey Dog. But somehow they're offering odds, and they seem to be tapping into this kind of general critical consensus that Silent Souls, yeah, a Russian movie, might win the Golden Lion. Tell me about it.
It's a film about set in sort of Nowheresville, Russia, a sort of provincial part sort of somewhere east of Moscow, amongst the Marian people, which I thought might even be a joke, but they actually really do exist. They were a kind of Finno-Ugric tribe who had their own language. They were pagan people, and they were sort of more or less assimilated to Slavs 400 years ago. But some of the names still survive, and some of the customs still survive, as the film kind of illustrates. And basically, it's a sort of love triangle of shot through with flashbacks and recollections where this woman has died, and her husband, who's a factory owner, takes his best friend, who was also the woman's lover, on a sort of journey to dispose of the body according to the Marian people's funeral rites. So they burned her body on a river, and then there are flashbacks to the relationships and whatnot, and very kind of striking scenes like where one of their customs apparently is tying tiny little bits of thread to pubic hair, so you get a sort of shot of that. And I see a lot of Russian films because I cover, that's sort of my beat for Variety. So for me, this was like best of breed of a lot of Russian films. It's very, very kind of typical aesthetic of long, long shots where you set up the camera, watch someone walking into a shot from, you know, the upper right corner and down to the left corner, and that's it.
Bit of snow?
A bit of snow. No, no snow in this one, but beautiful sense of the steps and the landscape and stuff like that. Beautiful landscape shots. It is gorgeously done, and those kinds of Russian films, this is a great example.
Yeah. Of course, a Russian film won here a few years ago, The Return by Zviagintsev, which was a beautiful film.
Yes, very nice. And I mean, I think this one is more oblique than the Zviagintsev film. Yeah, it's more...
That was quite oblique, as oblique as go.
Yeah, yes, exactly. But that one, at least you could kind of grasp onto a story more. But I mean, I think it's really silly of Paddy Power to put odds on this, because as we were saying before we switched the microphone on, you never know what jury's going to suspect. I mean, everyone's trying to second guess what someone like Tarantino, who's the president of the jury, might like, because there's lots of chop-socky stuff here, and there's lots of things, and, you know, who might he be friends with, and he used to go out with Sofia Coppola, let's not forget, and stuff like that. So, you know, but there's more than one person on that jury, so I don't know. It could be. It's been, a lot of people have really liked it.
There's that will be a high cinema decision, but of course Tarantino, as you said, presides over the jury. One of his mates, or one of Sofia Coppola's mates, is Vincent Gallo, who the sort of latter end of the festival sort of has dominated talk, at least, even though he's not bad. I've just come from a screening, and he's shuffled in next to me and sort of put his hat on and put a sort of scarf around his face, then kept looking round at me going, look at me, why aren't you looking at me, don't look at me, to watch this short film. His film Promises, written on water, was in competition. He's also in another competition film called Essential Killing. Zan, you've reviewed Promises, written on water. I suppose we should talk about Vincent Gallo and how this he's become the George Clooney of this Venice. Normally Clooney is the kind of poster boy for Venice, but it's somehow become Gallo.
Yeah, he's got two features here and a short, and yet for all that, you've probably seen more of him than anyone else has, that he's been holed up in his hotel room. He cancelled his press conference at the last minute. He says he's here merely as a technician, so he doesn't feel obliged to discuss his oeuvre with the press.
I wish he'd fix that bloody rope that's making a noise in the background.
You should have asked him. And so he came here, I guess, mainly with Promises Written in Water, which is the first feature he's done since The Brown Bunny, which was famously booed at Cannes a couple of years ago. And I think people came to the screening in a spirit of mischief, a lot of them. They were kind of hoping for a turkey. And on one level, you could say that they get it with bells on, because it's a very much a rigorous art house film, very experimental, shot in black and white, with lots and lots and lots of Vincent Gallo in it. He does the music. It's a Vincent Gallo Films production. He edits it. He writes it. He directs it. He wanders around.
Production designer.
He did the catering. And he kind of wanders around in it a lot of the time, looking in the mirror and chain-smoking cigarettes and basically being Vincent Gallo. It's painful in many ways.
It's only 75 minutes.
That's 5 hours of my life I'm never going to get back. But there's something weirdly honest about it, in that it knows exactly what it's doing. It's totally unapologetic. I would not want to ever sit through it again. But the weird thing is that there was a lot of people walked out, yeah. And a lot of people who stayed were kind of doing their crappy jokes and laughing at their own good humour and shouting at the screen. And actually, the longer that went on, the more I wanted to defend this film in that way of, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend, and that you kind of think, I don't really like this film, but I like it better than I like you people who are laughing at it.
I think you might be going for a strange, previously never achieved double of having the worst film ever to play in competition, both in Cannes and in Venice. And I sort of kind of admire the situationist humour of that, except I do think that Promises Written on Water, at some certain moments, achieves a kind of emotional intensity and honesty and something, some sort of tenderness as well, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah, there's some very beautiful bits in it. There's that sort of scene where he's almost kissing the girl and he keeps pulling back because he's not sure if he wants to have a relationship. Well, we're all inferring it because it was kind of rather obscure what was going on exactly between his relationship with a girl played by Delphine Bafour or something like that.
Never heard of him.
She's apparently a model or something. She's actually really good. And there were, you know, there were moments that were really actually suggestive and stuff like that. It just does strengthen so hard, doesn't it? With you know, it's shot in black and white. It's almost an Academy ratio. It feels very austere. It's a little bit out of focus, you know, which is always sort of a badge of authenticity. You know,
there's something of the student about it as well, which you think, well, come on, Gallo, you've been around long enough to not be doing student shorts anymore. But there's also something of Buffalo 66 about it, which I think was a very good film of his, rather than Brown Bunny.
Yeah, I think that's true. And weirdly, I came away kind of admiring him for just having the balls to do a film that's going to alienate at least as many people as The Brown Bunny.
Zan, what else has caught your eye in the latter stage of the festival?
Latter stage of the festival, there's one film that I went to see with Leslie, in fact, which I was very surprised by, called El Cine de Crimine. The Scene of the Crime. You're very good at this, Jay. You're like a native. This was a documentary by a director called Walter Stockman that basically takes us on a tour of the Naples underbelly.
Oh.
It's this sort of brilliant, free-floating film. It interviews sort of teenage gang members and people who are trying to lead a respectable life there, and like the old lag who's under house arrest, who's showing yellowing clippings of his crimes and boasting about that. Some people were saying that it was a bit vague and unfocused, but it has this... It's a bit like an Errol Morris film. It's a bit like The Thin Blue Line. Mm-hmm. It has that sort of weightless intensity, and it looks so beautiful. You've got like the crime scene photos, which are like kind of William Eggleston prints, and you've got these kind of these moped shots through the back alleys of Naples, and it just has this sort of dreamlike kind of intensity to it that I thought was great.
Oh, yeah, no, you've sold that to me. I really need to catch up with that. We can't leave Venice without mentioning the brothers Affleck, who are both here directing films, Casey and Ben Casey, with, I suppose, the big kind of reveal of the festival finally was Joaquin Phoenix really gone to seed in the film I'm Still Here, which Unveil had its world premiere here, the first time anyone had ever shown it. And Joaquin Phoenix showed up without a beard, even though in the film he's totally got a whole Vincent Gallo beard going on. There was a bit where I thought that maybe Joaquin was playing Vincent Gallo, but, you know, I'd had a little kind of too much to drink.
They were on the same day, so they all kind of blended in together a little bit, didn't they?
Yeah. But I'm Still Here, that clearly one of the big stories of this Venice, even though it wasn't in competition. I found it a very playful and kind of intriguing documentary. I don't even sure what sort of film it is. Is it a hoax?
I had a review for Variety, and we always have a sort of slug at the top sort of saying, like, you know, animated or, you know, and if it, or docu, you know, for documentary. And I was like, I put docu question mark because I really don't know how would you class it, because half of it, it's, you know, the closest thing it's similar to is Bruno or Borat.
Yeah.
You know, half of it is staged and faked. Or I don't know what proportion of it, but certainly some of it. And you could feel it in some scenes where it really does feel faked. And then a lot of it was true. I mean, if you go back through the tabloids and all the internet, you know, he really did at one point announce he was going to retire from acting and become a hip-hop artiste. He leaked on, you know, up on YouTube footage of him doing these atrocious raps. You know, we really, I mean, for
you,
someone,
you would be better. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, I'm sure you would be infinitely better at it as well. But it was just embarrassing. And then had what seemed to be like a meltdown over the course of a year, and culminating him appearing on Letterman to promote his film Two Lovers, which was going to be his last film, and just being completely inarticulate and looking like for all the world like someone who was just completely gouged out on something, some kind of drugs.
I mean, there's footage of him in the film taking a lot of drugs off the nipples of prostitutes.
Yeah, I mean, there were rumours there were going to be shots of him shooting up, and it's just that what he does is smoke a lot of joints and snort coke. Not that, you know, don't do drugs, kids. I mean, we're not condoning those and saying that. But anyway.
Nothing.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it was like some kind of really... So in the end, what was faked, what was not faked? Casey Affleck was fantastically cagey about it at the press conference and wouldn't really confirm or deny what was going on. But you just have your kind of instinct, and they're still trying to kind of be sort of a little bit cagey about it.
Zan, hoax or no hoax?
Well, I actually genuinely think that nobody knows, not even Casey Affleck, maybe. I think that the truth of this film is more complicated, that it is basically Joaquin Phoenix in crisis, a crisis of some form or another, fallen out of love with acting, wants to be a hip-hop actor, star, maybe, doesn't really know what he wants to do, but can't actually stop acting because that's all he knows how to do. So he basically then becomes what he is and acts it. So he acts like the spoiled brat who's having a breakdown. And then gets the film crew along to... You know, there's something weirdly tragic about it. It's a bit Day of the Locust. We're all kind of acting these roles and we can't break out.
But in the end, is it not then just a film about... Like a Hollywood breakdown film, like a Days of Wine and Roses, a kind of one of those films, a kind of meltdown movie?
Yes, I think it is. Yeah. And as such, it is funny and oddly sad at times. It worked for me, and actually the more I think about it, the more I like it. At the time I was irritated by it, because you're constantly trying to spot the scenes that are obviously staged and the ones that aren't, and trying to fit it together, but in doing that I actually think you lose the actual pure enjoyment of the film, and I think it is a good film.
We can't leave without Ben Affleck, who came with a much more traditional movie, a film called The Town, which refers to Charlestown, an area of Boston, which has produced, apparently, more bank robbers than any other square mile in the world. What a proud claim to fame that is.
Did you have it on a sign as you enter?
Bank robbery capital of Boston. It starred Rebecca Hall, Jeremy Renner, Ben Affleck himself, and then it was kind of heat-like, with heat-like chases, a conventional thriller, but I actually kind of enjoyed myself watching it.
Did you? I thought it was very much a lukewarm heat. It's got this terrible conceit at the centre of it, where Rebecca Hall plays a bank robber who's held hostage, and then...
She's
a bank manager. So I'm already forgetting it. Bank manager who's held hostage by a bank robber, played by Ben Affleck, who then spies on her afterwards, supposedly to keep her from squealing to the FBI, but then falls in love with her, which is like one of those awful first-person life experience columns, like, I fell in love with a robber who threatened to shoot my face off. That kind of thing. And I don't think it ever gets beyond that. I thought that a lot of the action sequences were brilliantly staged, great car chase, some good shootouts, but it's a bit of a bogus, cliche-ridden thing, I think.
Yeah, and hugely sentimental as well. But that's I do like a car chase every now. One thing about film festivals is there's not normally enough car chases in them, Leslie.
All films could be improved with car chases, but as far as I'm concerned. That's one of the things I don't like about theatre. There's no car chases and no close-ups. But, you know, I agree with Zan, actually. I'm afraid Jason and I wasn't such as a keen. I kind of didn't quite see what it was doing here.
I'm not keen on that. I just enjoyed it, because it's like a big Hollywood piece of crap in the middle of a film festival.
Festivals have to have a bit of totty on the red carpet, a bit of not just girls but boys as well, and have to attraction. So, I mean, I've heard people grumbling, well, what's it doing in the festival, you know? But you need that balance. Yeah. You need glamour as well as you need high quality films. And I think if we're drawing close to the end, I would just say this has been an amazingly good Venice. I think it's been really one of the best strike rates. We haven't even mentioned some of my favorite films that were much, much smaller things. They're sort of more pure competition festival movies, like Pablo Larraín's Postmortem.
Well, we'll be talking to Pablo in an interview exclusively for Film Weekly after this, because I liked it too.
Yeah, and that was one of my favorites. So I think it was one of the films that had the most visceral impact. And that terrific Greek movie that was on yesterday in competition,
Attenberg,
which was another absolute gem.
Really strange film. They're small films that they hit. The competition here seems to be fairer than somewhere like Cannes, which is a bit of a bear pit, and people say, boo, or that's by the genius, or it's kind of, you know, complete charlatanism and rubbish. Here, a film like Attenberg, which is a very small Greek, strange Greek film, gets quite a fair, like, it's interesting. I quite like the really bonkers clowns bearing machine guns and machetes Spanish film by Alex de Iglesias called The Last Circus. That's the sort of film that I think Tarantino will go, man, that's awesome, those clowns shooting people. That, I gotta see that. That could win.
There's another rather odd film that maybe won't play quite as well to Tarantino by the Czech animator Jan Vankmajer called Surviving Life. I'm really screwing up his name, aren't I? Which is kind of eccentric and whimsical, but altogether charming. It's a sort of an office drone who has these sort of Freudian dreams, these sort of sexual dreams, and it chases him through all that. And it's got this rudimentary mix of live action and animation, which almost looks like one of those old Xerox adverts where faces are kind of imprinted on photographic backgrounds and things like that. Maybe it sort of overstays its welcome a bit, but it was unusual and refreshing because of that.
It's no Shrek, though, is it? Sir?
It's no Shrek, but, you know, there are plenty of Shreks.
That does sound like a weird and rather wonderful edition of the 67th Venice Film Festival. Leslie Felper and Sam Brooks, thank you very much for joining us. Chilean director Pablo Larraín established himself as one of Latin America's most exciting young filmmakers with his critically acclaimed Tony Manero, a brilliantly observed dark comedy that made it into both mine and Zan Brooks' top 10 picks for 2009. Having wowed directors Fortnite at Cannes in 2009, Pablo Larraín is here in the main competition at Venice with his newest film, Post-Mortem. It's a tale of a state morgue administrator who falls for a beautiful cabaret dancer and secret political activist, who then disappears amid the mayhem of Chile's coup of 1973. Post-Mortem has set tongues wagging here on the Lido, and it's expected to be very close to the top prize here in Venice on Saturday night. So I dutifully sought out Pablo Larraín to discuss making the film and his reasons for revisiting this dark period in his country's history.
Salvador Allende Gossens.
¿Por qué? ¡Este hombre estaba aquí!
I'm sitting on the terrace of the Excelsior with the sea in the background. Venice actually is not sunny today. It's gone a bit grey. It's gone a bit grim. And I suppose that's kind of apt because I'm talking to Pablo Larraín, whose films kind of in the opening shots can make you feel chill and cold. Tony Manero, and now his new one, Post-Mortem, which I have to say was an absolutely fantastic piece of work, Pablo. Congratulations on it. But it did make me feel like death, in fact.
Well, yeah, it's a film that tells a love story between two person in back there in my country in 1973. It's a film that tells this love story, and I intend to do something that it's... I like to see how this little story get tense with the big story of my country, and see how those... how they fight together, how they get along together, and it's been great to be here. It's an amazing moment.
Did you... because the film has been very well received here, but for a film that's set in Chile in 1973, you wouldn't have thought that everyone was aware of Chile in 1973. It struck me how well that atmosphere that you have created has kind of transmitted itself to everyone. You don't have to be fully aware of the politics of 1973 Chile.
I strongly believe that films are not only made out of stories and structures and plots and subplots. What I admire in films is the atmosphere, the tone, the mood, and I work really hard on it. And yes, it seems to be working because people tend to say that it felt something very uncomfortable. And if you get an audience to feel something strong, no matter what it is, I think you're doing things a little bit right, and I'm very glad.
Yeah, for me, from the first shot, the tone was right. I say feel like death. I mean in a good way. I mean your lead character, he works in a coroner's, in a morgue, so he deals with death every day. It's his business.
Yeah, it's he's a how do you say in English? I'm sorry, he's a typewriter or something.
Yeah. Stenographer.
Yeah, yeah. He performed the inform, so he doesn't really do anything but write it. You know, the doctors says what he has to write. So it's interesting because it's a very insignificant, apparently, character. And through his eyes, we see the story of my country. Because many people have been wondering why did they pick a so tiny character? And I believe that people is the 99% of Earth is full of, you know, regular people, and maybe that's why the film gets close to the audience, because do you look it through somebody who's close to you?
Yeah.
It's not the president or somebody that important, you know.
I think it's very important that he is a writer, because the history of your country in 1973 is preserved in records, in written records in some way, not in film. But now you with Tony Manero and this film are sort of addressing it on quite a big stage, the world stage, through film now. Is that a slight kind of, is that why you're revisiting that era? Because there's not really much documented on celluloid.
Well, I believe there's a few films, maybe most of them aren't very well known. But I think it's interesting for me, since I didn't live those days, I was born 3 years after. It remains as a mystery for me, and it's funny, because it's the second film I've done on the same period, and I still don't understand it.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that I try to, you make a movie, try to understand something, and you don't get it, you know, but you still do it, you know that, and it's like it's like tragedy, you know. You escape from death, but you die anyway.
I don't really know what went on in 1973 in Chile, but through the two films of yours that I've seen, I think I know what it was like to live under those conditions without knowing what was going on at the top level in the politics. But to be a man on the street, I know what it was like. You had dreams of being someone big, dreams of being in Saturday Night Fever, dreams of being in love with a glamorous cabaret girl. Those are the dreams of normal people, and they get caught up in these big events.
The interesting thing is that I didn't live it too, so I don't know how was it. I just create a possible situation, a possible atmosphere, and I don't know if I'm close to reality. I don't think it matters really.
Did you speak to people who do live it? Presumably your parents lived it.
Yeah, my parents, many people that is around me. We did a huge research, documentaries, film stock, photographs, a lot of information. But what you get out of it is more than some concrete story. You get sensations, and I work with that, and as a main source, you know.
We're all very happy that you're kind of showing what life was like under a dictatorship in 1973 in Chile. What are Chileans thinking of it, to have their past exposed so publicly?
I think it provoked very divided and polarized opinions. Many people tend to think that we shouldn't keep doing it, you know, to keep making movies out of it, keep thinking about it. Many people think that we should just talk about different things. Chile now is a very different country. We are in democracy since 20 years ago. But I don't agree with that. You know, Pinochet died 4 years ago with $30 million completely free, you know. We still have a thousand of people disappear, and the people who torture and kill them is still on the streets. So I don't see anything resolved here, you know. I just see this huge black hole, and it's interesting to get into it and to try to see how to get out of it, you know.
South American cinema is kind of on the rise here. It won the Oscar for Secrets in Their Eyes, another film dealing with a similar period in Argentina's history. And other films in South America tend to deal with those recent pasts where politics kind of afflicted the masses. Is this Chile's time to deal with that? And do you think then Chilean film can move on? Given that you're at the forefront, I suppose it's up to you to lead the way, Pablo.
Oh yeah, but it's interesting because many Latin American films are dealing with the subject. But I would say that in my country, like last year, they were released films, horror films, genre films, action films, martial arts films. So I'm part of a generation who's doing a lot of kind of different stuff. And I am the one who's dealing with this matter. I'm the ET in this situation. But As long I and my team feel comfortable with it, we'll stay on it.
I got, maybe you bought so much period costume and so many kind of retro artifacts that you just need to use them in all the films. You can't afford a budget for anything modern.
We're thinking to close this project with a third and complete a trilogy. We'll see. Yeah. Since this is no Star Wars, we're trying to see to pick the right story before I could move definitely to something different. I want to do it anyway. I tell you,
got to use those flares up somehow. Your actor that you use in it, tell us about him, because he's an extraordinarily gifted performer. I was intrigued to see him the other night, the real guy. Yeah. I mean, after Tony Manero in this, I kind of thought, he's a man who just on screen can make you chill, because you never know what's going on inside, what's going to happen
that's
next.
That's exactly why I'm interested to work with him.
Tell us about him, where you got him from.
Well, he's a very well-known...
What's his name? Albert?
Alfredo Castro is a very well-known theater director and also an actor. And he has a drama school, so he taught me there, and that's where we met. And we started with this collaboration together, and he carries this mystery on if you talk to him, you wouldn't see it, you know, in real life. But in front of a camera, if he doesn't say anything, he's just standing there, you wouldn't believe what's going on, or you wouldn't know what's going on into his mind. And that mystery is something that keeps the audience vivid, you know, trying to see him, trying to understand, and you never do it. And I think that's very valuable. I believe that if you have a character that everybody understand fully what's going on with him, that lack of mystery is something that led the audience not to work, you know. You need, the audience must be there to close it. You have to deliver an open character, an open story, so the audience can also work and think with you and close it through their own eyes, through their own experience.
It's interesting because I've now spent two films in the company of this actor, and in both films I'm thinking he's an unsympathetic guy. I mean, this is not a particularly likable character that he's playing, but each time I'm totally with him, which is bizarre because that's a really difficult trick to pull off.
Yeah but I know a lot of people like that. I mean, disgusting people, but it's still interesting, you know, and that combination of emotion is something that I like, because it's hard to judge him, you know. You start judging him and then you start liking him also, so you don't really know where you're standing, you know, and then you laugh in moments that you shouldn't, so you feel bad. So all those things happen, and I think we reached something that I'm very glad with.
Yeah, I mean, he's becoming quite a star, Alberto. You're making him, I suppose, a star in South American cinema now.
Oh, hopefully. I'm very glad. He's wonderful, and he never thought it was going to happen with him at 55, I think he is. And he's been getting offers from different countries, from different films, and I think it's just wonderful.
Yeah, he's got great. He's very good with his hair. You know, he can do some good, brave hairstyles.
That's a lot of work, I tell you, because the hairs thing is something that it was a nightmare really to keep it the way it is on the film. Because you'll see it, but there's a hurt situation on him. Yeah.
There's a lot of flicking going on either side, and it's in his eyes, and I don't know how you shoot a man with that hair. Just tell me, one of the most striking things about the film, I suppose, is the look. And you mentioned earlier you looked at films from the time and different stocks from the time, but that faded, desaturated look, I don't know how you describe it, that you've got in your it looks like you shot it on actual film that you found from 1973 and was just in the back of your cupboard. Tell me how you got that look.
No, you know, when I start to I wanted to get a real vintage look, and I start to research how did they used to do it, and the answer is very simple: they did nothing, because they had no post-production tools. So we shot the film, and then we also used a late 60s Russian set of lenses that we bought in Russia, and those lenses are the one that Andrei Tarkovsky used. Not the same sets, but the same label, right. And the same, you know. So it's interesting, this anamorphic sort of grainy look that has this is close to painter for me. And I really like it.
I loved it. It's one of the most striking, those images and that feel, that tone that you wanted to achieve so much is something that is never going to leave me. I think it really seeped into me, that cold, chill, desaturated feel. But also, I thought the film was quite funny as well, which is quite strange because it's not really very funny. But
yeah, that's what I was telling you. If you laugh with a situation like that, you might feel bad, you know, or feel strange that you're laughing out of something so sad and violent. But that combination of emotions, I think it makes you think about it. And I think if you achieve that, it's beautiful.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure having you on Film Weekly. I'm delighted that you can come on because it's a brilliant film. I love Tony Manero and I missed you then. So glad to get you now. Pablo Larraín, muchas gracias and felicidades on your brilliant film, Postmortem.
Thank you so much. Gracias a ustedes. Saludos a The Garden. Gracias.
Thanks to Pablo Larraín. I don't know when Postmortem will get picked up for UK release, but distributors are sniffing around it as we speak. Well, that is all we have for you from Venice. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday if you want to read much more about my adventures here in Venice. The music you've been listening to on this week's show is by a Film Weekly regular. It's from the score to Tamara Drew by the ever-brilliant Alexandra Desplat. But from me, Jason Solomons here in Venice, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, back in London, it's ciao tutti.